Okay, everybody, I think it's 3:30. I think it's time to get started. So, welcome to this session. I guess people that went to Flash 4 did not take my advice and go to some other more useful session and said, somehow you found yourself here. Let's get rolling. Let the games be games. Aesthetics, instrumentalization, and game design. So why did I have this slide from showing Plato's Allegory of the Soul, the charioteer, while you were coming in? Well, a couple reasons. First, I wanted to let everybody know that this was a pretentious, highly conceptual talk, and so that was supposed to be your cue to leave the room if you really wanted something that was going to help you make better games. I promise to get back to Plato. Alright, who am I? Really quick, well, I've been in the game industry for almost 20 years. A lot of my earlier digital work was things like Sissy Fight or Gearheads. I ran a company called Game Lab for about 10 years. We made all the games there at the bottom of the screen. I've also had a kind of an academic life and done other kinds of projects too. I teach now at the NYU Game Center. I wrote a book with Katie Salen called Rules of Play and some other books. We do things at NYU like a practice conference that brings together game designers that make card games, board games, video games, and sports. And I do things like start the Institute of Play that has created some schools, public schools based on games and play as model learning. Since my company Game Lab closed a few years ago, I've really indulged myself going back into really experimental game design, which is really about my passion, and doing things like the metagame that I would look number 12. My last commercial title was a Kinect title called Leela that explores play and meditation. And I've been working with an architect, Natalie Pulsey, doing projects for museums, including the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, like 16 tons that's on the screen here. So that's me. Why am I here today? Well, I'm really motivated by a problem that's bugging me. It has to do with how we talk about games. And I call this problem instrumentalization. I'm here to tell you that the solution to the problem, or a solution, is thinking about games as an aesthetic form. And on the way there, I want to discuss a little bit how we talk about game design. But first, I want to talk about what's at stake and how games relate to the time in which we live. So this is basically the structure of my talk that we're gonna look at today. I want to say I'm not alone in a lot of these ideas, and I want to thank people whose work I follow and who's sort of in concert with mine. I want to thank Frank Lance, John Sharp, Colleen Maslin, Jesper Yule, Chris Hecker, who haven't just inspired me with their ideas, but also gave me feedback on this talk while it was in progress. So thanks to all those people. So let's take a look at what I'm supposed to be talking about today. These weird words. Aesthetics, instrumentalization, and game design. To try and start looking at these issues, I wanted to set up a process for myself that would result in a kind of maybe changing the way that I thought about games. And I wanted to really see games as an aesthetic form. And so I thought of a kind of a parallel field, right? What's another field that has, like games, it's a huge, varied realm of human endeavor that has its own history and theory and criticism. And I looked at art. A parallel field called art. So I dusted off my copy of Barton Theory, which I had from my art school days. This is this huge book. The pages are sort of onion skin paper. I think there's only like 1,800 pages in this book. And it documents, it's just crammed full of manifestos and essays and interviews with art critics and historians and artists and theorists. And one thing that looking at a massive cultural realm like art reminds you is that art really has never been just about one thing. And that's a really important idea I'm going to come back to. Art is this kind of weird competing soup and stew of ideas that's constantly changing and transforming the way that people understand what it is. So I thought for this talk that it has to go in this book and do sort of careful research and painstakingly find the kind of exact concise references that I would need for my talk. And I started out, that seemed so daunting to me, I just kind of opened up to a page at random. And magically, it was incredibly relevant to what I was thinking about. And I did that a few more times. This kind of like pseudo-random algorithm, you can actually see the bookmarks there in the book. So I was kind of like taking these random core samples from the world of art, and they were incredibly relevant every time, and I sprinkled them throughout my talk. So we have three of them, and let's just go to the first one as a starting place. So this is someone writing about the Dadaist movement. If you don't know, that was that absurdist avant-garde movement from the early 20th century in Germany, and they sought to really just banish all previous ideas of beauty and art and form. They really were very self-consciously an anti-aesthetic kind of movement. So what I'm going to do with each of these quotes when they come up periodically in my talk is that I want to sort of identify what are the art-specific words we use. So here, there's a few Dadaists, right, and art, and I make a change, right? So let's just see what happens. Change Dadaist to game designer, and if you change art to game. What happens now? When you read this, other than just being a gimmick, you know, the point of these quotes is to, it's kind of like a cultural random walk or something. Just open up our eyes to what games can be. And when you look at this, the game designer flings out his own personality as one flings out a lasso or lets his coat flutter in the wind, entirely devoted to the movement of life. What's interesting about this is that most game design theory that we hear about is about, like, what are games? How do they work? How do we make them? How do we understand them? This is not about that. This is about what it means to be an artist, or now with the transformation of game designer. What would it mean to think about what it means, rather than to make games, to be a game designer? What would that shift entail? I also like this because it's such a call against the status quo, right? The game designer considers it necessary to come out against games. Games regarded from a serious point of view as a large-scale swindle. And I guess it may be hard to argue with that. I want to ask an important question as we're here kind of starting out on my talk. And that question is, why does any of this matter? I want to convince you guys, first of all, that games have a special relevance to the time that we're in. And that games are going to be the defining cultural form of the next 100 years. And this idea, I call it the ludic century. I'm going to have to give you like a 5-minute condensed version of what's sort of a 2-hour talk, but we'll see how we go. So here it is. Here's the idea. Thinking in terms of really big epics. In the 20th century, there was this industrial age, which was replaced by an information revolution. And my question is, what's next? What's happened after this kind of information age? Well, I want to argue that we're now in something new. That's just beginning, or maybe has already started, or we're already fully in, called the ludic age. And ludic, of course, comes from the Latin word for play. So information, in a sense, has been put at play. If the 20th century was the age of information, and the moving image was a kind of dominant paradigm for art, entertainment, leisure, the carrier of personal narratives, from the news and history to storytelling and personal expression, in the 20th century, there's a sense that the moving image has been put in play, that it's no longer a kind of a stream for one-way communication. And along with the rest of culture, the moving image and information, visual culture, has been sort of dislodged. It's now sort of modular and customizable. The lines are increasingly blurred between audience and artists, or producers and consumers. And games have a special place in this transformation. Now, the argument that I want to make about the ludic century is really an argument about literacy. And so literacy, you know, in its traditional form is really about creating and understanding meaning, right? So if I write something on this paper like I have to write something short. Okay. That's kind of unimaginative, but here we go. So I wrote something on this page, right? Well, what just happened in this act, right? I had a thought or communicated something, I wrote something you understand. It's that process of meaning transmission, that's what literacy scholars, that's what literacy is to literacy scholars, right? Now, literacy has traditionally meant, well, sort of oral literacy and written literacy, and it's been expanded, right, to include things like visual literacy, technological literacy, more recently. But what I want to say is that there's a kind of a new set of skills, right? There's kind of a new set of things that are clustering around this idea of literacy. So what it means to be literate today is a kind of new set of is a new set of practices and things that I call gaming literacies. Now, I'm not saying that games are the only way to understand these, but they are a really excellent way of thinking about what it means to be literate in society today. There are three components to this, and today I'm only going to go into one system. But I hope to convince you that that what it means to be literate is different today. So what is this about systems, right? So many of our aspects of our lives today are completely intertwined with systems in a way that they just weren't 20 or 30 years ago, right? The way that we work and the way that we learn, the way that we socialize, the way that we kind of flirt and romance, the way that we conduct our finances, the way that we engage with our government, all of these incredibly core aspects of our lives, at least in industrialized countries, are completely enmeshed with networks of digital information, right? So there's a sense in which we're like fish swimming in an ocean of systems every day. And I want to convince you of two things. First, that these literacies, like systems literacy, in a sense defines the time that we're in. But I also want to say that games are the cultural form that really does embody this kind of literacy, right? So if we think about games are the cultural form of systems. Now, while it's true that every cultural form is a system, right? A poem is a system, and a piece of music is a system, and a building is a system. Games are systemic in a way that I would argue goes much, much deeper, right? To play a game is to really engage dynamically with a system, to try out the limits of the system. What happens if I do that? A game is kind of like a laboratory for learning about how systems work. And to play a game, to play it deeply, to play it well, means to think systemically, right? So what I'm trying to say is that games are incredibly relevant to the time in which we live. Computer technology and video games are both cause and effect of this. And the kinds of problems that we face in the world today, like pandemics or global economic disaster, environmental collapse, they require this kind of gaming literacy to solve these problems, right? Seeing the world as a set of parts that interrelates to form a whole, and how these parts can be redesigned and rethought and reconfigured. So what I'm not saying now, that I'm not saying that, hey, games are the solution to solving the world's problems, right? I'm actually saying the opposite, that this way of viewing the world as utterly recombinable systems constantly at play is here, whether we like it or not. And as the makers of games, we're not doing some kind of niche cultural form sort of off to the side of a bigger, more important cultural thing. We are making the patterns and templates that are going to guide this central cultural form for the next 100 years. Games are so many things. They're math and technology that pivots into psychology and emotion, storytelling and aesthetics, into interpersonal interaction and social dynamics, physical interaction and desire. Games really are poised to be the central cultural form of the 21st century. And for me, that's why it's so important to figure them out, how they relate to other cultural forms and what makes them unique. And that brings us back to aesthetics. So hello, Plato. Welcome back. I promised you that we'd see Plato again. So this is a talk in part about how we discuss and understand games. Now this image I'm showing you is an illustration of the allegory of the chariot from Plato. It's not just a kind of a random thought. It's a model. It's a concept. As Marvin Minsky from MIT Press would say, it's a thing to think with. It's about several things. It's about love and aesthetics. It's really a model of a person. This chariot thing is kind of like a little conceptual sim for the soul. The black horse is the sort of dark desires, the id, right? That kind of drags down the chariot with its earthly desires. The white horse represents the normal elements of the spirit, temperance and courage. And the chariot here is the rational intellect, trying to sort of steer them both, right? The whole idea of this model is that, as Plato puts it, the higher the chariot goes, the closer it gets to the divine. So the goal of the chariot here is to kind of move the chariot up on the y-axis, essentially. And the actual vector of the chariot is kind of like the average of the two forces between the two horses, you know, like a physics problem, or maybe they're competing AIs trying to pull the chariot in opposite directions. This discourse is really a discourse on love, because it's earthly beauty that creates desire, right? It's earthly beauty that seduces that raises the fire of desire in the black horse, and the resulting soul's battle to resist the bad aspects of desire as the good aspects prevail. Now, this is another model for love, very different model, and it's from pickup artist culture, the mystery method, and it's not just an abstract idea. It's another rather complicated model. actually. This is a diagram showing, I think this is an overview diagram from the entire left hand, which is the approach or pickup, to mid game and the end game, the seduction game, in this particular method. This is a guide to very detailed terminology and very detailed algorithms that you're supposed to follow. I was actually drawn to study pickup artist culture initially because I was fascinated by the way, you know, sort of the AI problem of how we represent people, right? How can we possibly stylize something infinitely complicated like love and seduction into a formal system to make it sort of manageable, right? How do we turn that into a set of rules and structures and knowable procedures? Now, the game, as it's often called in pickup artist culture, it's not all that. I mean, it has been credited, for example, with making nerds social and making them comfortable with flirting and dating. But on the other hand, it's also been accused of perpetuating the worst kind of gender stereotypes and gross objectification of women. But I want to say, actually, there's something deeper and more perverse about pickup artist culture, that it instrumentalizes human relationships. It reduces them into systems and structures and org charts. It turns the inevitable into something numerical. Human relationships become instrumental in the mystery method. They're sort of functional algorithms in a larger program. And we're not just talking about any kind of human behavior, but we're talking about desire, about love. Now, I tried out the system for a while when I was single. You guys like that look? several years ago. And it can help. I mean, the funny thing about this sort of pickup artist culture, it can turn you, it can get you late, right? But it also turns you into kind of like a weird autistic flirting savant. So that even while your dating life blooms, there's this kind of like scrim that comes up between you and the rest of your social interactions. You start to think about all of your conversations and interactions, not just the ones where you're trying to flirt with someone, in terms of body language or power dominance or interpersonal politics. So the problem with the mystery method is it's not a question of efficacy. Can it get you laid? It can. It's not a question of accuracy. Does it correctly stylize human relationships? Because there's a million correct ways to model something as complicated as human interaction. For me, what I want to say is that what's lost when we instrumentalize love? What's left out? Because what happens to love in the mystery method and pickup artist culture is what I see us doing to design, and what our games are doing to our players, and what we are doing to our games. And I call this instrumentalization. It's the reduction of games to some kind of functionalist automaton, like the way love is reduced in the mystery method. And why is this called instrumentalization? Well, because in pickup artist culture, people are reduced to instruments for getting laid. So it's a model for understanding the world and our place in it that violently reduces complexity rather than opening up complexity. Let me pivot into games with another example of what I mean. Alan Kay, I heard him speak a couple years ago, a pioneering computer scientist. He developed the graphical user interface and object-oriented programming, really a personal hero of mine, was talking about Guitar Hero. And at the end of his talk, he lamented sadly that that the game was not teaching music, but at least a few of the players were getting interested in learning rock and roll guitar as a result of playing the game. And I thought, oh, Alan. At first, it actually sounds kind of good, right? But if you think about it, like, hold on a second. Teaching rock and roll guitar is good. That's just kind of a presumed, you know, positive thing. 50 years ago, the idea of teaching rock and roll guitar and rock and roll guitar itself was downright satanic, right? It was seen as part of the downfall of civilization and encouraging sexual perversity in the youth. You know, but Alan Kay today just takes it for granted that playing music, studying music, making music is good. It's just part of being human. But playing a game is clearly a waste of time. Game designer Frank Lance has commented that in 50 years, that there's going to be some other cultural form that the crazy kids are doing, and that will be seen as lamentable and a waste of time. And people are going to say, well, it's really a shame that they're doing this horrible thing. But, you know, at least a few of them are getting interested in playing video games. The problem with Alan Kay is that he never questions that music is part of being human. The games are being part of human too, like telling stories or making images. Games are really an essential part of our humanity. And I want to make two points about what Alan Kay is doing here, because this little anecdote, in a way, is a kind of microcosm for my whole talk. On the one hand, he is instrumentalizing games. He's implying that games, and in this case, Guitar Hero, is only useful if it ends up teaching music, right? That's why games are an instrument, maybe in this case, Guitar Hero, for getting people involved in music. On the other hand, he's clearly seeing music as an aesthetic form. Learning to play an instrument clearly needs no justification at all. It's good, it's beautiful, it's beneficial, it's important for its own sake. And this is usually part of what we mean when we say that something is an aesthetic form. So my intention with this talk is to question this kind of equation, to stop instrumentalizing games, and to rethink that maybe games could be considered an aesthetic form. This is what I mean, that by thinking of games as an aesthetic form is a kind of antidote to instrumentalization of games. Now, I don't think it's too hard to find examples of how we instrumentalize games. Let me just go through a few. This is on the academic side. This is a panel at the American Educators Research Association. This is a very featured central panel, and they wanted to look at, you know, the games, this debate about games. So what was the actual debate? Well, it was a debate if computer games are a useful medium for student learning, or if whatever could be learned from games, you know, might more effectively and more efficiently be learned somewhere else. This is how top researchers are representing games, how games are being represented to the larger research and educational community. And I want to say that this is a problem. We're strict-mining games. We're damaging the very thing that's meant to be valuable. And in doing so, we're playing right into Roger Ebert's hands, who famously said that you know, the games were not art. Just compare, for example, if we were book lovers, right, instead of game lovers. Actually, many of us may be book lovers. If we were passionate about books and learning, dedicating our careers to books, would we spend time trying to prove how great books are, or how educational books are as involving as non-educational books, whatever that would mean? Would we make book-based curricula or advocate for book-based learning or better and more educational books? Would we spend our time figuring out the right formula for the most effective book, or be actively trying to bookify the world? The whole idea of educational books is strange. Now, there are some explicitly educational books. I mean, they're textbooks and reference books, but they're just a little tiny sliver of how books kind of can direct and impact and engage learning. So if we were concerned about games of learning, we should be less concerned about building the perfect book, and instead we should want books and games in schools the way books are in schools. Books are not vehicles for injecting content. They're just part of learning. They're part of being an educated person. They're just part of these larger processes. They're part of being a literate person, a good person, part of being human. And that's much closer to what educating is, at least for me. Meanwhile, here's the reality, right? We're seeing, at least in the games and learning field, this kind of throwback to 19th century ideas of testing and education is information, and that games are kind of vehicles for injecting data into players. This is just an incredibly impoverished idea of what education is. Of course, while we're while we're bashing low-hanging fruit, gamification, this ugly word, it is literally the instrumentalization of games, using aspects of games, points, levels, and rewards in the service of something else, to sell something, to get you to opt into an email marketing campaign, to suck money out of your pocket. What's so wrong with this? And by the way, thank you, Darius Kazemi. I don't know if you're in the audience, but this is an actual photograph from a conference that he attended. So this is, I think it's not ironic, actually. Not meant to be ironic. Naomi Clark and I, a year ago, gave a talk called The Fantasy of Labor. And we explored the idea that gamification is a problem, not just because it results in sort of bad and horrible games, aesthetically. It doesn't just cheapen games, but it dehumanizes players. Because it's premised on an extremely impoverished model of what it means to be human, this kind of Skinner box of rewards and punishment. So the problem with gamification is that it sees games merely as vehicles for marketing or other behavioral change. And that's just an incredibly impoverished idea of being human. It goes against other things like, I don't know, pleasure, creativity, beauty, meaningful social interaction as a premise for play. This is how we're playing right into Roger Ebert's hands. Arguments about games that justify them like this have kind of seeped out into the culture at large, right? And that's how a lot of people outside of games are understanding what games are. And it's cheapening games. Of course Roger Ebert would look at some instrumentalized idea of what games are and say, oh yeah, of course they're not art. Because they're like Alan Kay things, right? They might be a vehicle for getting us to something useful, but as long as they're being framed as just instruments for something that we don't question, then of course he wouldn't consider them as art. So I want to ask, is it possible to think about using games, the use of games in education, without instrumentality? And I think it is. I want to look at art education just for a second. This is part of the larger discipline of education. Now, my parents were actually professors of art ed, and that meant that they trained teachers for public schools. They had grad students also that were studying teaching methods, and PhD students studying things like the psychology of education, or history, or critical studies of education, or policy work. What I want to say is that art education teaches us that it's possible to think about education based on an aesthetic form, art in the case of art education, without instrumentalizing it. I'm just going to give you one example. This is an art educator, Brent Wilson, and he's talking here about, as you can see, visual culture. We exist in worlds filled with visual images. So there's this idea of visual world. What are the questions that he's asking? He's asking, he wants to know, do these visual worlds enrich our lives? Do they create knowledge? Do they help us know our values, our futures, and ourselves? Do they bring us joy and pleasure? Right? So he's talking about not just art, but the visual culture that we live in. These kinds of questions that he's asking are not about how much information an artwork can transmit into the mind of a participant. Even just to say that out loud in the case of artwork just seems so silly and absurd. Now I realize that most of the people in this room, including myself, games and learning is not your main thing. So I want to move on from that. But I want to say that this simple-minded approach to games and learning, or gamification, it's the ally of Roger Ebert. Is that really what we want for our games? I want us to stop being so apologetic. I want us to be able to say without hesitation and apology that games are beautiful. That we don't have to be apologists for games. We should be the opposite. We should be snobs and connoisseurs of this beautiful form that we're working with, this beautiful cultural form, because games are beautiful. Alright, next break for art. This next quote is from Guy Debord. So he was an extremely important figure in the Situationist International. And here he's writing about the theory of the derive, or derive if you have an American accent like I do. The derive was this kind of interesting sort of algorithmic user-driven drifting, right? As you can see, he says you basically you let go of your work and leisure activities, and you kind of let yourself be drawn by the city. You kind of let yourself wander through the city. And it's meditative. He says it's about letting go. But it's also, he says, just the opposite. The derive includes this letting go, and it's necessary contradiction. Because the whole point of the derive was to get you attuned to what he calls the psychogeography of the city. Which is the kind of like the kind of power, dynamic power structures of being in a city. So let's think about this and to do this to our little swap again from this completely random word sample from the world of art. The only word here I found that I really needed to swap was cities. And let's see what happens when we change that to game. It actually really kind of reframes this whole idea in a very new and interesting way. I think, for example, can we do this kind of like meditation / research in our games? Maybe games already do this, right? This idea of letting go and plus intentional observation. Something that already happens, you know, that we have our rational problem-solving mind and our kind of meditative mind together in those games when we play them. I love this quote, from this point of view, games have a psychogeographical relief with constant currents, fixed points, and vortices, which strongly discourage entry into or exit from certain zones. Now, is that not one of the most beautiful descriptions you've ever heard of, like a real time strategy map choke point analysis, or a fighting game zone control, or a MMOG character death heat map? But you know, actually, the derive is even more radical than this because it occurs in real space. It's actually a way of gamifying space, in a sense, but without instrumentalization. Why should all this matter? Everything I'm saying in this talk about instrumentalization and aesthetics and design. The way that we talk about game design is important. Because it very directly shapes the kind of games that we make. Now, there's a critique of talks like this one that I'm giving right now to you. It's kind of long-winded theoretical argument. And that critique is pretty hard to ignore. And that argument is, shut up and go make some games. This slide, by the way, is dedicated to Jonathan Blow and Chris Hecker. Why? Because we're designers, right? Game designers are designers. We're not scholars, we're not journalists. And our main form of expression is making games, not discussing and analyzing them. So our most eloquent and important conversation about all these issues takes place through our games themselves, right? But if our main form of exploring design ideas is actually creating games, this is a pretty slow conversation. If it takes 6 months or a year or a couple of years to make a game, over a decade, this dialogue that a designer might have with his set of ideas, might have just a handful of statements going back and forth, like some gathering of ants, right, where they take 10 or 20 years of deliberation to arrive at a decision. But conversations are facts. Ideas flow much quicker than games. So a conversation that you and I might have in 5 minutes could completely change my mind about something or set a new idea off and get me thinking about my next game. Games are slow, but ideas sort of flow in and about and around them. They infest our thinking, they shape our concepts and design decisions. Talking leads to doing. So how we talk about games is important. I think it has a big impact on how we make games and why we make games. So the question is, how do we talk about games? Now, it's easy to bash educational games or the idea of marketing via games for instrumentalization because they are about instrumentalizing games to use them for some other purpose, right? Or for learning something or for getting money out of your pocket, as the case may be. But I want to argue that there is a kind of instrumentalization that's also going on in game design. So what I see happening among arguments of game designers and discussions is that too often we seek to promote a proper idea of what games are, how they should be defined, how they should be understood, how they should be made. It's a kind of instrumentalization of game design. And I want to coin a term to describe this. I want to call it design fundamentalism. Let me give you a few examples. Now, David Jaffe, who's a designer who makes incredibly great games, and says incredibly smart things and interesting things about games, recently gave this great talk at Dice that they actually really liked. And he asserted that there was a problem, that game designers try too hard to tell stories, to be like films, at the cost of understanding what's great about games. And I actually agree with David Jaffe. I mean, I've been talking about the problems of cinema envy for many years. And I agree with him that games aren't doing themselves any favors by hankering after the pleasures of cinema. But what I'm getting sick and tired of are arguments where designers feel the need to assert what games really are, that they are this and not that. Here's another designer from whom I have the utmost respect, whose games are sometimes unspeakably beautiful. Here's another position that Trent Hawking has put out there, that I think this is from writing on his blog, that I more or less agree with his position and what he's saying. But there's this sort of design fundamentalism. Right? There's this idea of that's not what a game is, right? It's as if a designer has a problem, or has an issue, or a point of view, a sensibility to explore, but has to turn that into a normative statement, a fact about games. And we don't have to do this. Here's another example, Tale of Tales, Michael and Ori. I love those guys, and I love how they want to question and undermine all of our assumptions about games. But again, they fall prey to design fundamentalism. These are all, in a sense, overcorrections. Premise an idea that games need to be one thing, that there's a right and proper kind of game to make, or a right and proper way to see players, or a right and proper way for understanding what a game is. And look, I do this too. We all do this. Here I am at talking about the immersive fallacy, right? And I'm saying this is not what video games are. They're this and they're not that. But I want to say that, so I'm putting myself in this pantheon of all these other designers who I really respect and adore, but who also fall into this trap. We don't have to do this. Now, I call this fundamentalism because it's premised on the idea that the point of design is to find a truth, right? That my God is right and your God is wrong. So forget about cinema envy. This is like a kind of science envy. About finding the correct answer, uncovering the right and true interpretation of nature. And this is science envy, but not even science envy of contemporary science, how contemporary scientists practice it. This is some like weird, super rationalist, 18th century Enlightenment idea of science. Design fundamentalism is a problem because it keeps us from exchanging ideas, from enjoying our contradictions. I'm against being narrow. I want to expand our ideas about what games are. Games are not one thing. And there is room for many correct, contradictory ideas about what games are. Because game design is not a science, and thank God for that. So if game design is not a science, it's not a discipline seeking to establish right and wrong, it's not science in this kind of extremely classical sense of uncovering the truth of nature, then what is it? What is the nature of truth for game designers as we explore our ideas? Because I don't just want to throw out my hands and say, oh, you know, everything is true. It doesn't really matter. We can accept everything. So here's where I land. Truth is utility. For a designer, the value of an idea or a concept or a thing to think with, use Marvin Minsky's phrase again, is not its ability to explain nature, to be right or wrong. It's its ability to be useful. We are not scientists. We are designers. And the value of a concept is its ability to be used in the rough and tumble of solving a design problem. So rather than a concept being true, what's important is whether or not we can use it. Let me give you some examples. Here's Marc LeBlanc. He has this wonderful framework, mechanics, dynamics, and aesthetics. Is it useful? Well, not all the time. To be honest with you, I often get confused about the difference between mechanics and dynamics, and it drives me crazy. On the other hand, there are things about his theory that are incredibly useful to me at times, like the idea of using aesthetic goals as defining the vision for what a game is. Design concepts are kind of like wrestling moves, right? When you're training with a coach on the mat, in practice, you can be very orthodox about them. You can say, okay, in this stance, you know, the back foot's at a 45-degree angle, the front foot straight ahead, you have 60% of your weight on your front foot. But what happens is that when you go into a mat, right, you have to improvise. You use these more orthodox, no one uses an orthodox technique and stops a wrestling match, right, and says, well, hold on, let me check the proportion of weight on my foot. You have to improvise, right? You have to put these ideas into practice. Here's some more ideas. Steve Flink and Game Field. It's an amazing book, a series of concepts that link perception and cognition to design and interaction, really capturing the flow of the game. On the other hand, there are times that I'm completely confused with it. For example, that it doesn't apply to a game like StarCraft because he draws this line in the sand where cursor clicking, delayed interaction doesn't fall into this idea of game feel and game flow. But game tools are not always useful in every situation, right? Batman does not use his batarang on every episode. But you have them there, right? There are things that you can learn and acquire and hopefully be able to use in improvising in situations. For designers, concepts are tools. Now, Doug Church, a brilliant designer who really, I think, has started a lot of my thinking about this with Formal Abstract Design Tools, a very, very early essay with this idea. He talks about this idea that, not every tool is useful in every situation. He really, really thinks about design concepts as tools. For me, design concepts they're like knots, you know? Sailor's knots. The funny thing about sailor's knots is that there's an incredible rigor to them, right? There's probably centuries-old history and tradition to these technologies and techniques of how to use knots, right? You can practice them. You can spend time practicing your knots. But really, you also have to know how to deploy them. Because once you set sail on the open seas of actually developing a game, you know, it all goes to shit. You know, your rigging gets tangled, the storm cuts holes in your boat, you know, your pants fall off. You have to improvise, right? You have to use your tools in ways that you never thought you would. Maybe you use a bowline as suspenders on your pants to hold them up, right? Probably the best known concept for my work is the rule of play that I did with Katie Salem. The book is a magic circle. This idea of how games are separate from ordinary life. Is it useful? Yeah, it's incredibly useful. You know, when I'm working on a game, it really lets me focus and think about just the logical components without worrying about the kind of messy social and cultural aspects of games and how they're separate from ordinary life. On the other hand, is it useful to break or discard? completely useful at certain times. 16 tons, actually inspired by idea by Yes for You All, I introduced real money, right? Something that broke the classical magic circle and produced all of this incredible incredible interaction and really gave the game a huge amount of life. So design concepts are things to think with. Part of our challenge is to be open, to stop design fundamentalism, to exchange ideas, right? To share our tools and our toys with each other, which is, of course, what we're doing here at GDC, right? Why we're all here today. And so, actually, thank you, GDC, for that. Third art quote. Leo Steinberg was a critic in the 1970s, not an artist. He was writing at this sort of age when America was kind of taking the crown of high art back from Paris, and artists like Jackson Pollock and Robert Rauschenberg were turning painting inside out. Steinberg has popularized the term art for art's sake, this idea of artists as pure visual expression, transcendent from day-to-day sociocultural reality. And if you look at what he's talking about here, he's talking about this kind of vertical picture plane, right? The screen as a window into an illusionistic world that we've inherited from the Renaissance, but which has been thrown away in the art world for almost a century ago. And he's talking about a shift, the tilt of the picture plane from vertical to horizontal, that parallels the shift in the subject matter of art from nature to culture. All right, so let's do our third gimmicky swap here. Let's see, picture can go to game. And when he talks about the picture plane, I call it the video. I thought that made sense. So image and image to game, and you get the idea. So what happens here? We too in games, in a sense, are a slave to the vertical screen. Not just in terms of cinema envy and imitating the experience of the motion pictures, but this whole idea that the vertical screen is kind of a window into an illusionistic world, right? Even if that world is something that's made out of big chunky pixels. What would it mean to not privilege the vertical screen as a central element of a video game? I don't know. What would that mean? Maybe then we wouldn't have to represent nature, even stylized versions of nature. Maybe we would represent something else, like rules or systems in our games. Maybe we would think about how the screens connect us, right? Maybe the horizontality is about how the screens are interconnected through networks. Or maybe we would abandon screens and pixels altogether and we end up with something like JS Chat. So maybe these questions are totally irrelevant to your work, right? These particular questions about horizontality and the picture plane, but that's okay. Because as an aesthetic form, games are not one thing. They're many things. Now, I've been talking about games as an aesthetic form this whole talk, right? So let's really try to understand what that means. Maybe as a starting point, we can use this idea, Leo Steinberg's idea of art for art's sake, right? This idea of something that's done for its own pleasure. John Sharp, designer, recommended this book to me, which is amazing, by Leonard Cohen. It's called Which Aesthetics Do You Mean? And he looks at the term aesthetic, how it's used in English. He offers 10 definitions, 10 ways that we use this term aesthetic. Some of these definitions just contradict and overlap each other. I'll just give you a couple examples. As appearance, now this is the actual example sentence from his book, right? Charlie is not concerned about the aesthetics in the sense of superficial surface, right? He's concerned with the actual essence, the functional or substantive aspect of a car. Here's a different idea about how aesthetics is used, the style, right? A particular style. So in this case, it's an edgy aesthetic, right? We can imagine other kinds of aesthetics. Maybe a romantic aesthetic, or a poofy aesthetic, or other kinds of aesthetics, or Bob's Law in Manhattan. But I think that for my talk, what I'm talking about today, we're probably talking mostly about beauty. We're talking about this kind of aesthetic. So in this quote, Anne, who's relishing the aesthetic experience of the summer sky, she's not looking up in the air because of the weather, or she's not using the stars to navigate a boat or something like that. She's just appreciating the sky as a pleasure for its own sake. We need to celebrate games for their own sake, right? We like I said before, we shouldn't justify them because they make you better. We need to be snobs about games, right? We should have the idea that you are out of touch world outside the gamer world, and you're ignorant if you don't play games. But appreciating games as an aesthetic form means more than just thinking about games for their own sake. For example, it also means thinking about games alongside other cultural forms. in the context of kind of wider cultural issues, right? So we want to think about games alongside books, or film, or architecture, or painting, or fast food, right? The kind of quote swapping that I did from the world of art, we really could do from any cultural field. Seeing games in new ways by seeing them as part of a larger landscape. In terms of seeing games as an aesthetic form, the last thing I want to say is that it's about seeing games not as one thing, but many things. For example, if you just think about those three quotes that I had from that book, those three random quotes that I just happened to turn the book open to, the Art and Theory book, it was the first one was Dada, right? A rejection of art as a large-scale swindle. And remember, thinking about not what art is, but what it means to be an artist. Bringing your personality out like a lasso. The other was something totally different, right? The Deriv, right? This experience of kind of drifting meditation, but also analysis of cities. And then also this kind of picture plane shift from nature to culture, right? So the idea of asking you, hey, which one of these is correct? They can't all be correct, right? Well, that's silly, right? That's this idea that games are just like art. They're not one thing, they're many things. And it's wonderful to embrace these kind of contradictory and different ideas about what art is. Now, there's a critique in my talk that I myself have my own design fundamentalism, that I'm advocating for games as an aesthetic form, as the one right thing. But what I'm trying to say is that thinking of games as an aesthetic form means not having one right answer, right? That my point is that games are many things. This is the opposite idea of reducing games to a vehicle for some narrow idea of art or players or games or proper culture. Thinking of games as an aesthetic form means thinking in terms of multivalent, contradictory, inclusive, expansive modes. Okay. I want to leave you with a couple of open threads here, a couple of open thoughts. One thought is that that I don't really have time to fully explore, but I think are sort of part of the same realm of ideas. One thought is that maybe, just maybe, we don't want to put games shoulder to shoulder with other forms of culture, right? That we want to think about not just how they're like other forms, but also what makes them unique. Maybe considering games as an aesthetic form just might have the potential to completely reinvent what aesthetics is. Maybe Roger Ebert is right? Not because of the kind of instrumentalized idea of games, but because games are themselves so different than the traditional fine arts, that there's something beyond it or outside it, that there's something else. For example, is it possible that games have a peculiar quality of aestheticizing instrumentalization, right? That they make problem solving itself. Instrumental problem solving, an aesthetic activity that's done for its own sake. Now, Frank Lance has actually explored this idea wonderfully in a couple of recent talks of his, and he calls this games making thought present to itself. I call this the madness of Plato's white horse. This is a huge topic, by the way, the unique aesthetics of games, which we'll have to leave for another talk, maybe next year. The second of two open threads I wanted to talk about is something quite different. Game design is a practice, right? What it means to be a game designer. Remember, like in that Dada quote about Dada, not what are games or how do we make them, but what does it mean to be an artist, or in this case, to be a game designer. Jonathan Blow, several years ago, ended his talk with a slide of himself doing Kung Fu or Tai Chi. And he talked about this very thing, right? Can we see game design as a kind of meditative practice? And I completely agree with him. My activity as a game designer, my kind of whole constellation of activities, which include teaching and writing, giving talks to like this one, enjoying culture, like film and books and television, and of course making games. All of that together somehow is a practice, right? And in a sense, the games that I make are sort of the residue of this practice, right? So I'm just kind of exchanging ideas with people and moving forward in the world, trying to understand games better, or myself better, or the world better, through this practice of game design. I'm not religious myself, but I think that games and game design, for me, could be my spiritual practice. Okay, conclusions, which really are suggestions. Here they are. Let's celebrate the Lunar Century, right? That games have this amazing relevance to the times in which we're living. Also, we want to appreciate games for themselves, right? Let's not fall into the trap of Roger Ebert by instrumentalizing games. If we're interested in games and learning, if that's your interest, let's think about models for learning which are based on an aesthetic form, but don't instrumentalize that form. And I offer art education as one model for that. I think that we want to recognize that our discussions about design do shape the games that we make. So yes, we should shut up and make more games, but also we need to keep on talking about them too. Game design is not science, right? It's not about one right approach. Game concepts are like sailor's knots, right? That truth is utility. Concepts that can be rigorously useful, but it's not in every situation, and that's okay. And we want to be a snob about our beautiful, important games, this cultural form that we're all making, because games are not one thing. They're many things. Okay, and at the end now, I want to return to us here in the room right now. Because beyond all this kind of high-flown talk and big words about the, you know, ludic century and instrumentalization and aesthetics, defining them, I want to be able to say very simply that games are beautiful, that play is beautiful, that design is beautiful. You are beautiful. Thank you. Naomi Clark.
Thank you so much, Eric, for giving us and sharpening for us so many tools to skewer sacred cows with. I know you love killing sacred cows, so I'm wondering if there might be an even bigger one. I'm wondering what you think of the instrumentalization of games for pleasure and fun and leisure. You know, thinking about it, there are a lot of people who take great pleasure in games who maybe don't care a whit about the aesthetic form, right? Who just want to play the same exact game mechanic over and over again, and just explore only one game, perhaps for their entire lives, because they find such great utility in how it provides them with, you know, in their downtime, with fun, with relaxation, with a way of turning their, you know, their mind away from other things.
I think I get you. That's a great, great question. I think that actually pleasure is one of the most difficult to understand and under-theorized aspects of game design, and it's incredibly central, right? In a sense, as game designers, we're sculpting pleasure, desire, challenge, and frustration. And I think that the instrumentalizing idea of pleasure, right, that it's kind of rewards and punishments, can be useful in certain situations, but it's not necessarily what games are. And to me, there's so many other ways of looking at pleasure. Just as, you know, pleasure to me is one of those concepts it doesn't resolve, right? If you think about the source of our contemporary ideas about pleasure, really in a lot of ways come from Freud, right, and the unconscious. Now the unconscious, by definition, is a thing that you can't know. It's like darkness. As soon as you shine a light into it and try and understand it and bring it out of kind of unconscious lack of understanding into the light, it's no longer the unconscious, right? It is itself kind of sort of mystery. So to me, we can understand pleasure and theorize about it, and we should, but there's also a wonderful kind of unresolvability to pleasure, right? That is, in a sense, it's like a David Lynch film, right? It doesn't make logical sense. It's not like a puzzle film. I think it's the difference between, for me, a film like Memento, which is sort of a puzzle, and if you actually put it backwards, it all makes logical sense. Mulholland Drive, on the other hand, or Island Empire, David Lynch's other films, they don't resolve. They're not meant to. There's no kind of hidden skeleton key which explains everything, right? And so I think that, for me, pleasure is like that. And I think that's part of what I'm saying. I think thinking about games as an aesthetic form, letting go of the kind of scientific sensibility of design fundamentalism means embracing and accepting paradox, right? On things that contradict each other, on things that we can't know. And I think that, in a sense, game designers are kind of analytical people, right? Because we juggle a lot of numbers and we like making structures. We work with structures. Structures and rules, in a sense, are raw materials. But I think that sometimes through this design fundamentalism, that structural thinking leads to this kind of scientific idea. So So it's a great question, and I think that there are ways of thinking about pleasure that are maybe less instrumentalizing than what you mentioned. So thanks. Yeah. Scott.
Hello. So I liked a lot of the points, but some of the examples of what we shouldn't be doing with fundamentalism seem to undermine or to actually be doing what you're ultimately championing. Like, if you're going to speak to someone, especially who is outside of design, and not fundamentalize, not reach for one true truth about what games are, you're going to have to relate it to their experience, which is outside of games. And so you're going to be comparing it to other things. You're going to be justifying game design in games in terms of what they know, which are not games. So how do you not be fundamentalist about not being fundamentalist?
That's a really good question. And I think, in a certain sense, it's a matter of time. That's sort of what the ludic century idea is about, right? That I feel less and less that there's a sense that we as gamers, we play games and we make games and we're interested in games. There's a sense in which games, through this kind of idea that our whole culture has become systematized, are more and more the sort of substance of what our daily lives are like. That I think that the way that people spend their leisure time is going to be more and more like a game. Like the cell phone that everyone has in their pocket. It's kind of like a game, managing the minutes you might have left on your account, the battery power, the signal strength, the information of the address book, not, let alone all the ways that you tweet and post and listen to your voicemail, right? So there's a sense in which I think the people who can only understand games, like Alan Kay, who, again, I criticized him with extreme admiration, right? But I think that what he stands for in that anecdote, I think is kind of hopefully an endangered species, right? That Roger Ebert's an endangered species. We just don't think about music just as that example, right? We don't have to say, well, to understand and appreciate music, you have to think about music like we think about, you know, food. Because good music is like good food. Don't you understand that it's sort of, see, and I think that more and more games are going to become, when I say that they're going to become the dominant sort of cultural form in the next 100 years, they may not be games, but I think the way that we spend our leisure time and the way that we tell stories and personal narratives in this kind of systemic, customizable world is going to more and more resemble games. So in a sense, that work is being done. So I'm less concerned about being prescriptive, and the whole ludic century thing is also kind of observing what's happening and saying, hey, wait a second, right? We're not in these kind of niche cultures. We can actually, in a sense, be comfortable with who we are and not have to try and, expand the tent, because this tent that maybe we were trying to expand is actually the sky, right? That we're all already in here. So, anyway, thanks, Scott. So it's a really good question. This time, I have like 2 or 3 minutes, maybe 1 or 2 minutes. Okay, I'll try to be fast. Harder reading.
Just discussing instrumentalization. What are your thoughts on using instrumentalization in a more rigorous scientific fashion just to create more resonant experiences?
I didn't quite hear what you said.
So the use of instrumentalization to create more resonant experiences.
More resonant experiences.
So just in terms of like using scientific rigor, just in terms of like neurological impulses.
You're saying, can we have aesthetic goals like, hey, I want to use this game to create a resonant experience?
More specifically, the study of use of psychology to understand what is resonant about the experiences to thrive.
Right. I'm not against rationality or rational approaches to games, right? I think that one can use the scientific method or research in wonderful ways, either parallel with games or, you know, I mean, I often frame what I do as design research, right? Research, using Peter Hall's categories, research about design or for design or through design. So I think that research has a place. But I also think, again, we want to think about, like, filmmakers, right? Filmmakers don't necessarily don't necessarily study the intricacies of the exact emotional response to every moment of their film in order to make a great film that's meaningful to us on a human level, right? It's more about crafting an aesthetic form. So games are, the great thing about games is that they're in this weird space, right? Because they are in part, games are sort of designed, right? Like you design a chair, there's utility to a chair. We have to be able to use it. Games are also, could be like art and aesthetic form, right? Games are also technology. Right? So by being all of these different things, in a sense, I want to be able to think about them all together, even if those ways of appreciating games kind of contradict each other. So it's tricky philosophical ground, because like I said before, you could say, anything is instrumentalization, right? Are you instrumentalizing games, saying that they have to be this or that? I'm really trying to make some observations about the way we talk about games now, in an attempt to open up conversations about them. So thank you very much, and I think that's all the time we have. All right, thank you guys very much.